All right. You have two handouts today. Romans 1:21, that we dug into a bit last Sunday. Romans 1:22, one of the shortest verses that Paul ever penned, professing phaskontes, to be wise, sophoi. It's an interesting word, translated wisdom or wise. It's a basis for sophisticated, sophistry, sophomore after the first year in college. Sophomores think they know it all. They became foolish. Moron theson. You don't have to pay too much attention to find the basis for moron in that word. Professing themselves to be wise, Sophia, Sophoi in this case, they became immoron theson. They became morons. Because, as the 21st verse says, having known, we've been over that enough, God upset his wrath, orgy, slow boil, as distinct from thumos, fire breathing, the slow boil, patient, long suffering, leaving his footprints everywhere. He's now having fulfilled the redemptive foundation, paid the price of his son. His son paid the price of his life. Raised him from the dead and launched the escape machine of the gospel. I paused on that word machine. That wondrous news, good news, of a way out of our condition, an escape, if you will, from the wrath of God. He is. Now it's an either or. It's the gospel or the wrath. And the gospel is obtained by faith, and the wrath is gotten by everything else, including religiosity, good works, and all the other things that those who profess themselves wise and have become morons offer as the alternative. The gospel seeks a hearing of faith, and the faith walk from faith to faith moves out from underneath the wrath. Galatians has it pictured in Greek words that have the wrath of God falling like a guillotine. The restraint has been pulled, and it's falling. Nothing will prevent it falling. Christ prevents it falling on us. Literally, the Greek has it, we pass out from underneath, being made a curse for us. The wrath fell on him. Faith takes you out from underneath, and that's the only escape route. That's the gospel message. What is now being emphasized is everything else. from the most primitively ignorant to the most self-professed sophisticated, is under wrath. Because, having known, it's there to be known, the God, they glorified Him not as God. He doxasan. You've heard me talk about kabod and kabodic, the glory of God, usually associated with light, that which produces awe-inspiring reverence and worship and humble awe before Him, that which you see in Isaiah 6 when He says, I saw the Lord high and lifted up. And then He saw Himself, a man of unclean lips who dwells in the midst of an unclean people. That attitude before the kabod, the kabodic of God. Doxa is used to translate that. One of its early root meanings was opinion, which is why we get words like orthodox, right opinion, heterodox, multiplied opinion. But that word is carried in a side stream of a shorter verb form. The root here, as you see on the piece of paper handed out to you, is doxazo. Doxazo. That is the stream that incorporates the opinion that is intuitively felt and grasped and illustrated by Isaiah in Isaiah 6, or Moses, who stands before the supreme God, or that which God sought to convey in both the wondrous grace of forgiveness if the priest met his terms and stood in front of Him properly and the sacrifice was adequate, when the Shekinah glory, brilliant light, settled on the Ark of the Covenant on the mercy seat. That stream of an opinion that is awesome in its respect for that which you stand in front of, worshipful, recognizing a contrast of worth between self and God, respectful, praise and honor is the meaning that the verb form took apart from simple opinion. It's a right opinion of worship and praise. Knowing that God is there, the footprints are obvious. They didn't worship Him. Give Him glory or recognize the glory that He is. Nor thanked Him. Eucharistison. You know, Boyce points something out in his preaching on this verse. I'm going to read it to you. He says concerning this Eucharistison, it's interesting to note. First, he says there are two pertinent questions. This is James Montgomery Boyce, his expositional commentary on Romans. He preached at the 10th Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia and also on his radio program, the Bible Study Hour. It's interesting. No, first he said, two pertinent questions. Are we who know God thankful? Do we express our thanks verbally? Any of you on the way here today? When you woke up this morning, don't raise your hand. Hurry in to get to church. You thank Him for life another day. Thank Him for the opportunity to be a witness to the value of His Word. No matter how you felt, You express it verbally. With the heart man believeth, with the mouth, literally proclamation is made unto salvation. And Boyce says, it's interesting to note that in many of the world's languages, giving thanks is the basic meaning of at least one word for prayer. A very important Greek word for prayer is eucharistio, the one that's here in this verse, which is derived from the liturgical word Eucharist. The Eucharist is the Lord's Supper, and it refers to that aspect of the communion service that involves thanksgiving to God for Christ's atoning death. Eucharistio means to give thanks. One of the most important Latin words for prayer is gratia, from which we have derived the French and English words grace. It has two meanings. On the one hand, it means God's unmerited favor, which we have emphasized much. That is the most common meaning of the word in English. It's the meaning in the hymn Amazing Grace. But gratia also means thanksgiving, the meaning we retain when we speak of saying grace before a meal. Isn't it interesting that so many of these words for prayer mean thanksgiving? And isn't it significant that the chief element in the opening of the heart of man to God in prayer, after recognizing His preeminence and His glory, and standing in reverence within the spirit of your being, the next act is thanksgiving. The Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. It starts with worship, and then thanksgiving. How many have developed that habit? Give me just a little more, Mike. How many have developed that habit in their prayer life? Those against whom the wrath of God is being poured out see the signs of God's presence. They don't worship. They don't thank Him, but became vain. Mateos is the root word. It means worthless, deceptive, delivered up to deception, empty, empty-headedness, really. Let me read something here that shows the vanity of these empty-head morons. All of this just happened by chance. That which has God's footprints on it, as we've been teaching, and I'm getting into that later. All of this vast macro and micro universe that we stand as the meso universe in the middle of, it just happened. It just happened by a process called evolution. Selection of species. Fred Hoyle, the famous opponent of Darwinism, said that the chance of, this is vain thinking, mind you, that he's condemning, the chance of natural selections producing even an enzyme is on the order of a tornado's roaring through a junkyard and coming up with a Boeing 747. You want to hear that again? We're to believe all this evolved. Your textbooks that your kids study in school, where the religion of no religion is propounded, they have their minds bent out of shape. end of the tunnel I ended with last Sunday from Smith and we'll go into again today, by studying from the earliest science classes, the little funnel or spiral of enzymes and cells, the little slugs to on up to the highest form of apes or chimpanzees, and then to man, the highest animal. All by natural selection, chance. Fred Hoyle's now famous assertion is that the chance of natural selections producing even an enzyme is on the order of a tornado's roaring through a junkyard and coming out with a Boeing 747. Think about that. And you understand, became vain as a replacement for awe and worship and thanksgiving to a God that did all this. No problem with analyzing what God did. It became vain, empty. Here's this wondrous tome again. Am I boring you? Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, Volume 4, Mataos, the word that it says, they become vain in the workings of the human mind apart from God and revelation, which is the dialogismos, that is being translated here, reasoning. New International Version is thinking, and the King James Version is imaginations. Phillips, argumentations. Their argumentations, thinkings, imaginations, reasonings are mataos, or a version of that word. The word denotes the world of appearance as distinct from being. Worthless because deceptive or ineffectual. To the same group belong, certain other words, matao, to waver, matuo, to seek. The basic sense always seems to be to fumble, to grope uncertainly. I think it's Smith again who uses the illustration of a drunk who's looking for his keys. On a real dark night, the keys to his car under a lamppost. Well, is that where you saw them? No, but it's the only place I can see. I mean, is that where you lost them? No, but it's the only place where I can see. Come on now. The drunk who lost his keys. And he comes to his car and he doesn't have his keys. Pitch dark. So he goes to the nearest lamppost where there's a light. He's looking for his key there. Is that where you lost him? No. But this is... No, this is the only place I can see. You understand? Fumbling around, unwilling to recognize who God is. The handiwork of a craftsman. You say, well, the handiwork doesn't require that. Obviously, I quoted Carl Sagan last Sunday. Obviously, you can draw another conclusion. You know, we put people in jail and fine them great prices. And it's a big problem in the music industry today as the third world with no respect for law steals copyrights and steals music and makes CDs and peddles them in Hong Kong. And the owner of that copyright gets PO'd. God's PO'd. He holds the copyright. He made it. And some fumble bum is still looking for the key in a life where it was never lost. Maybe next Sunday you'll catch up to me. So last Sunday I introduced heathens. They have an initial response, even though they may be guilty of what is later on described as a push from God into the wrong direction they seem to persist in following. They usually start out. Archaeology and anthropology has long since proven and dispelled the notion that man began polytheistic. No, he didn't. They began with a recognition of one supreme being. And that's what God says to those that have not yet encountered His special revelation through a special oracle people, through the Word made flesh and intruding, and the most shattering proof of someone other who intrudes into this stream of life and the resurrection that scientifically blows their assumptions apart, and that's why they don't want to look at it or talk about it. God's fed up with them looking and looking and failing to recognize who He is, supreme being, craftsman of the universe, with His fingerprints everywhere, that anyone but a moron, using that word, who thinks with empty, fumble-bum reasoning, would say there has to be, somewhere behind it all, a supreme craftsman. And I introduced the problem of today's world, where Satan, the prince of this world, has totally captured the mind of a generation. The book is Houston Smith, Why Religion Matters. And he postulates a difference between science and scientism. Those last three letters. Scientism, if I can trouble you to hear this brief little distinction again, he makes clear there is a distinction between science and scientism. Why Religion Matters, Houston Smith, Professor Berkeley, UC Cal. For this Stanford man to be reading a Berkeley professor's book is an accomplishment in itself. Our arch rivals up there. Scientism. Only four letters, tism, separate scientism from science. But that small slip twixt the cup and the lip is the cause of all our current problems relating to worldview and the human spirit. Science is on balance good, whereas nothing good can be said for scientism. Scientism adds to science. Two corollaries. First, that the scientific method is, if not the only reliable method of getting at truth, then at least the most reliable. Second, that the things science deals with, material entities, are the most fundamental things that exist. And then he postulates a generation living in a tunnel. The tunnel has a floor, two walls, and a ceiling. And here we are, going through life in that tunnel. The floor of the tunnel, not science, scientism. The worship of science as the best, if not the only, way to find, discover, and know truth, and that, what's the second one? If you're tested now, what is it? Speak up, somebody. Huh? No, I'm not talking about the walls. I just read the definition of scientism. What are the two corollaries that are added? What's the other one? Huh? Material things are the most fundamental things. That's the most real things that exist. Right? Method? Only or best. And it's subject matter, material things. Only things that exist. That's scientism. And we're captured with it. Whether you know it or not, it affects everything that you do. It's why most Christians don't believe in miracles. And most Christians don't believe in miracles. They can add it to their foundation belief and say miracles happen, but they don't believe they happen now. Because scientism does not allow miracles. Now, Smith wrote a previous book. His previous book, in addition to The World's Religions, was a little book called Forgotten Truth. And as he expounded on the tunnel, the walls on each side, the left wall, education, starting with higher education. The right wall, the law and the legal system. And the roof, the media. Scientism being the floor, higher education, taking this belief and shaping our brains accordingly, the law, trivializing religion, putting it in a second-class status, and building its premises and decisions on scientism and the media, the least educated, the least educated, and in terms of profession, probably among the most ignorant, and the most hypocritical, because in the name of seeking truth, they totally reject the religious frame unless it's based on scientism, which puts them into a frame where God is just some poetic myth, because only that which can be demonstrated realistically is real to us. Anyone in religion who talks of the supernatural, who talks of miracles, is less than acceptable. That's why the media is embracing. You see Croson all the time in various ones of the so-called Jesus Seminar, embraced in the media. You don't find supernaturalists unless they happen to be of a minority group. I mean, only minority groups that in their own little snide way, they still do consider inferior. Therefore, they're tolerated like the Amish to be religious. They're tolerated to talk about religion. In music, they are respected for their gospel roots. But these WASP media people with their token minorities will not show respect to one of their own, race-wise, that believes in the supernatural. Because in their view, that's sort of reducing them to the size of the minorities that they tokenly tolerate. I want you to understand the disrespect they have for me is mutually shared. And furthermore, until one of these journalists walks in with a PhD from a university on the par of Princeton, Harvard, Yale, Stanford, Cal, etc., the burden of proof is on them to show me they got a brain, not the other way around. And I speak that way because through Paul I'm speaking for God today. That's the way he feels. Now this tunnel, dominated and founded at the floor by scientism, supported by higher education and the legal system, and parroted, and that's about the best illustration I can pick, a parrot that taught to talk, parroted by the media, is the tunnel we live in. That was the general frame yesterday, or last week, seems like yesterday. Yeah, last Sunday seemed like yesterday. Now I want to pause, lest I hurry too quickly out of this section of Romans 1. I don't expect to be out of Romans 1 into Romans 2 until about 120 messages. I'm giving God a challenge. Keep me alive till I finish Romans. Now, I therefore, with the wall, the gestalt in front of you that Smith has so eloquently painted, I want to concentrate today on the science frame. I mean, I only brought a few. They looked at me when they carried the books in today. Man, I've lived with this stuff the last week. Einstein's miraculous year. 5 papers that changed the face of physics. And it did. Einstein's universe. Relativity made plain. That's impossible. The amazing achievement of Albert Einstein and what it means today. Oh, and this is, as they try to nominate a replacement, my vote would go to Stephen Hawking. Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time, from the Big Bang to the Black Holes. I painted that. Stephen Hawking's Black Holes and Baby Universes. That's a suggestive link-up, as I would think, you know. He does have a sense of humor. Black Holes and Baby Universes and other essays. And, you know, he was not born with the defect that he now conquers with modern scientific elements that enable him to sit in a wheelchair and punch buttons and even have worked out tonalities in the artificial speech because of the terrible congenital disease that has crippled him, and most people see him in that state do not know. He was on a champion rowing team in school, and it was much later in life sickness that hit him. And he's a living example of courageous plowing through infirmities and deformities. He's a living testimony to what handicapped people now wish to call opportunities. And he's to be admired and a mind second to none. Black Holes and Baby Universes and Other Essays, and Stephen Hawking's Universe, and I must have read through 10 books yesterday, not counting the ones I'd plowed through earlier in the week, trying to get a sense of why God was PO'd at what is now the modern, brilliantly gifted substitute for those through history that have aroused God's wrath by simple, willful refusal to step aside in awesome worship of the craftsman who did it all. The same thing that plagued Adam and Eve. They didn't want to have everything else but recognize God's sovereignty. As long as that tree was there forbidden, no matter how much else they had, and without a thought that they were a clod of dirt until God formed them and breathed into them and they became a living soul, they still wanted it all. And the sales pitch, you do what God said don't do, you'll be like Him. The desire to play God, whether it's as primitive as that original story, be it, in your view, myth or reality, I choose reality, which makes the sin all the greater. God, forming Adam out of a clod of dirt. Eve, who betrayed her husband, made from his rib. Wanting to have it all. Wanting to be on top. Wanting to be the boss. Wanting to play God. Wanting to make their own decision. Wanting to be subject to nothing. Everything else was subject to them. They never had a sympathy for those that were subject to them. They could not live with being subject to the one who made it all. That's what God's still mad about. And He loved us enough to rescue us from that confounded condition. And whether an ancient idol maker or a modern, brilliant scientist who is not satisfied to use his gifts as science, to revel and increase his attitude of worship and appreciation for the Creator, he must master it all. And get the glory himself and the thanks himself. Houston Smith expanded upon this in this little book, The Forgotten Truth. Visioning the way things are, there's no better place to begin than with modern science. Equally, there's no worse place to begin, or to end, rather. But that's for later. For now, it's the beginning that concerns us. Science is the fitting starting point, partly because its achievements, according to Herbert Butterfield, outshine everything since the rise of Christianity, others have claimed since the invention of language. Even more pertinent, however, is the fact that science dominates the modern mind, including yours that's listening to me. Through and through, from premises to conclusions, the contemporary mind is science-ridden. Its sway is the stronger because we are unaware of its extent. There may be no better way to summarize the scientific view of things than to say that reality is a stupendous spatial hierarchy, a hierarchy of size. And I might point out, the first syllable comes from the root for holy, and the second syllable comes from the same root as archos, ruler. Holy ruler is the basis behind hierarchy, but that's long gone in science. Spatial hierarchy. The scientific view says that reality is a stupendous spatial hierarchy, a hierarchy of size. In its middle register, in which our daily lives are lived, we encounter objects carrying the proportions of inches, feet, and miles. In the micro world that undergirds this conscious world we live in, cells measure on the order of thousandths of an inch, which ought to produce awe toward God. Thousandths of an inch. Atoms, hundreds of millionths of an inch. And atoms' nuclei, thousands of billions of an inch. As we continue downward, or rather inward, from nuclei to nucleons and their ingredient particles, the orders of inverse magnitude continue to unfold exponentially. You know, it took me a long time to realize that when I stand in front of something like this, and you're looking at it, it's solid. I remember in my first introduction to physics, it's hard to go back that far, but I remember how unbelievable and how I was going to be forced to totally abandon my sense perceptions of reality and come to view what was not seen as the essence of reality instead of what was seen. And we don't think that through too often, as the media and this tunnel around us makes us believe that such statements as Paul made, we look not on the things that are seen, but on the things which are not seen. And we are supposed to put our hope and our life and our trust in invisible things, promises made by an invisible God. We're asked to do that. And I remember the shock to my system and view of things when I had this difficulty of adjusting my sense perception to reality. That this piano here, for example, is only solid relatively. It's only solid because I'm too big to go through its parts. It was very hard for me to understand that this is mostly space. That to an electron, it could go through that with little resistance. Particularly radiation clusters could go through it. This is not solid. It's mostly space. Moving so fast, it looks solid. This is not static. This piano, indeed this building, indeed you, are a foci of constant motion. Temperature is related to speed. in the movement of these particles. And that what I thought was solid and stationary is mostly empty space, relatively, and in constant movement. And in that piano, take it down to its smallest parts, and I've told you, atomos is the root for atom, which means incapable of being divided. And Aristotle, again, talk about scientism being the floor. Aristotle and his logic's the basis of our language, the English language. Aristotle saw air, fire, water, four basic elements. From them, everything was made, and there was nothing else. That was the basis of the early alchemists trying to melt things down and change the nature of things. But now science has found out that the atom can be divided. It can be smashed. And it has much smaller particles, and therefore that which, without scientific instrument, Aristotle reasoned, there must be something so small it cannot be divided. And when the atom was first discovered, it was given that name. And now we're dividing the atom. We're going down beyond that to molecules of and electrons and protons and neutrons. And protons come from a Greek word also, which means first. They thought they had found the primary. Now they're way down to strange names like quarks and gluons, and even somebody getting humorous to glue boxes, where they go together like hairballs. Now the latest theory is the basic ingredient of a reality, strings, either unconnected strings or connected strings that produce a sort of funnel effect, or just strings. And all these basic particles are caught in strings. That's the latest theory, as they pursue clear down into the micro, thousandths of inch, nuclei thousands of billions of an inch, reversing our direction. We enter the macro world. Now remember, to think that all of this, with us in the middle, the meso world, with this billions and billions and billions exponentially smaller in constant movement, we're in the middle. We encounter all of this real world, unable to be seen with the naked eye, proven that it's there because of the effects it causes. And that's what God says, proven I'm here because of the effects I caused. Oh, they'll believe that these little things they give fancy names to that they will never see in their lifetime, that their conclusions have been wrong on. First, light was waves. Then it was clusters. And now the clusters act like waves. And some still debate on it. I stand at a position in the middle, and almost infinitely smaller things that make it up. Now I look out to the horizon. Reversing our direction, we enter the macro world. Our sun revolves around our galaxy at a speed of 160 miles per second. Now that means that sitting here right now, all of us are going 160 miles a second. I know that most of you have had enough science to not be startled by that. But just think about it a minute. We're asked to take that, most of us, on faith. How many of you have an experiential feeling that you're going 160 miles a second? Man, I would have put my horn on the freeway today and said, look out. You're to take it on faith. Faith in what science has determined by analysis and extension of sensory apparatus and give evidence for, that we're revolving around our galaxy. That's not going around the sun. This is our sun. Revolves around our galaxy. About 23 times the speed a rocket must attain to escape from the Earth's surface. At this speed, it takes the sun approximately 240 million years to complete a single rotation around our galaxy. Like it takes 365 and a quarter days for us to go around the Earth, to go around the sun, it takes 240 million years for the sun, dragging us along, go around the galaxy. I can hardly wait to get there. If the orbit seems large, it is in fact parochial. Small. For it's confined to our own galaxy, which is but one among estimated billions of galaxies. Andromeda, our closest sizable neighboring galaxy, is 2,200,000 light years away. And beyond it, space falls away abysmally. Nebula after nebula, island universe after island universe, until we reach the limits of what is now estimated our known universe, some 26 billion light years across, whatever that means in four-dimensional pseudosphere. And here we are in the middle of these two extremes. I mean, if that doesn't scare the liver out of you and make you know you need somebody to help you, but not the modern Adam and Eve, I can be God and figure all this out. Modern science requires only one ontological level. Now, ontology is a section of metaphysics. Metaphysics deals with reality. Ontology deals with being as that part of reality. Science accepts only one ontological level. Already said it in scientism, which is a philosophy growing out of the temporal successes of science. There's nothing wrong with science. Nothing wrong with exploring God's creation, which should produce the attitude of the psalmist and the songwriter, "How great thou art." Worship and thanksgiving. The cry when you understand what even the most primitive man felt in his being as he looked at the night sky. What is man that thou art mindful of him? That's this pinpoint, infinitesimally smaller than that, relative to the whole, the macro and the micro, that God's Son would come here for you and me. No wonder God's angry to be ignored. And to have His creature, creation, worshipped above Him. Because it elevates the worshiper above Him. They have only one ontological level. The physical. All reality is reduced to the material. Within this level, it begins with matter that's perceptible. And to perceptible matter, it in the end returns. It's self-occupying, no more than a single ontological plane, saying that's all there is. Science challenged by implication the notice that other planes exist. They can tolerate no competitor. As its challenge was not effectively met, it swept the field clean. Gave the modern world its soul. This tunnel, the only way to live, the only route to truth. This is the final definition of modernity, an outlook on which, or in which this world, this ontological plane, is the only one that's genuinely countenanced and affirmed. You talk about something else, to the media? Yeah. You go into higher education frame? I can see you've got a good mind and you can make good grades, but what is this vestigial remnant of your emotional tie to your father? It cannot be acceptable as academics. All they're possibly seeing a vision of the Madonna in a window. And you see little smart-aleck yuppies with their microphone running around asking questions designed to make these people appear foolish in their faith. Nothing is countenanced outside this. In religion, modernity demythologizes tradition to accommodate it to its one-story universe. Hence the death of God. The best way to characterize this worldview is to say there's fundamentally only one kind of entity in the world. That's the kind studied by natural scientists, physical objects. And second, there's only one kind of knowledge in the world. It's the kind that natural scientists have. And that's the quote from Willard Quine, the most influential American philosopher of the last 20 years. That the scientific... Am I boring you? That the scientific outlook should, in Carl Becker's words, have ravished the modern mind is completely understandable. Through technology, science affects miracles. Skyscrapers that stand. Men standing on the moon. Moreover, in its early stages, these miracles were in the direction of the heart's desire, multiplication of goods and the reduction of drudgery and disease. There was the sheer noetic majesty of the house pure science erected, and above all, there was method. No wonder man was converted. The conversion wasn't forced. It didn't occur because scientists were imperialists, but because their achievements were so impressive, their marching orders so exhilarating, the thinkers jostled to join their ranks. Strictly speaking, the scientific world is impossible. It's a contradiction in terms. The reason that science does not treat of the world, it treats of only a part of it. One world at a time, one hears, fair enough, but not half a world, which is all that science can offer. Though man's conversion to the scientific outlook is understandable psychologically, logically involves a clean mistake. And insofar as we allow our minds to be guided by reason, we can see that to try to live within the scientific view of reality would be like living in a house of scaffolding, and to love it is like embracing one's spouse's skeleton. Well, you that watched Saturday Night Live last night saw Mango do that to a skeleton. I'm going to see your viewing habits. All science can do is look down this tunnel. Science cannot handle certain things. These are the things that this one worldview cannot see. Values. The sphere of values lies out science, except insofar as science consists in the pursuit of knowledge. What I'm going to say is so obvious that to say it is self-evident. But we don't say it to ourselves enough to erase the enclosure of the tunnel that guides our behavior like a frame of reference we don't think about. Science cannot give you values, except the pursuit of knowledge about material things. Science gives you no answer to purpose. That's why education, to get ahead of my story, reduced life down to simple existence. You are the purpose of life, simply to be and to be satisfied. And you being and being satisfied is the end that justifies all means. Value is what works for you. Truth is what works for you. Because science can give no meaningful purpose to any of this. Science is impotent on values and on purpose. It can give no meaning. What's the meaning of life? Does it have a meaning? Science can't answer that. Quality. This is basic to all the others. Because the qualitative ingredient in values, meanings, and purposes that accounts for their power. Values, life meanings, purposes, and qualities slip through science like sea slips through the nets of fishermen. Yet man swims in this sea, so he cannot exclude it from his purview. This is what was meant when we noted earlier that a scientific worldview is in principle impossible. Are values important? Raising your family? Are questions of meaning worth exploring? Purposes? Qualitative differences? All science can give you quantitative differences. They can tell you quantitatively what polls of people reveal as to what people think purposes are, but they can give you no guidance other than the Democratic vote. With science itself, there can be no quarrel. Scientism is another matter. Whereas science is positive, contenting itself with reporting what it discovers, scientism is negative. It goes beyond the actual findings of science to deny that other approaches to knowledge are valid and other truths true. In doing so, it deserts science in favor of metaphysics, bad metaphysics as it happens, for as the contention that there are no truths save those of science is not itself a scientific truth. In affirming it, scientism contradicts itself. It also carries marks of a religion, secular religion, resulting from over-extrapolation from science that has seldom numbered great scientists among its votaries. Science has enormous difficulty dealing with things that cannot be measured if it can deal with them at all. Now, what has this got to do with this verse of Scripture? Vain reasonings, empty, self-deceptive reasonings that produces morons. Morons in a tunnel. Long before some of the modern scientists took their ideas further, I mean, Einstein hit the world with his special theory of relativity that dealt with the very obvious once it was articulated, and then his general theory of relativity, which boggles the mind, that things that seem to be are not, that light doesn't travel always in a straight line, it's bent in space, that the shortest distance between two points is not a straight line. As his theory of relativity enabled us to begin to explore the outer reaches of space, he then played a major role in quantum mechanics, which opened the door for exploring the micro-universe. And with all of these theories, we have opened up both dimensions. One of the most startling things about the universe is that all these galaxies are moving away at a tremendous rate of speed, but slowly slowing. And they're now able to calibrate the speed in light years with which these galaxies are moving away. And it looks like, at first glance on Earth, that every galaxy is moving away from the Earth at a certain speed. But if you were on another planet or even another nearby galaxy, it would look like that to you too. It's one illustration I read someone using. It's like you're a raisin in a loaf of bread that starts to expand like bread does. You understand? And as it expands, you see every raisin that was formerly next to you going away from you. But every raisin has the same impression about all the other raisins going away from them. This is really the basis using Einstein's theories for the Big Bang. If they're moving at a certain rate of speed, and if they're slowing down as they get more distant, you can calibrate in mathematics the reversal of back to the beginning. That somewhere, if they're all moving away, they're moving away from something. And therefore, you reverse, to oversimplify the mathematics, you go back to where they all started from. Boom. And that initial burst was such an explosion that everything took off at a high rate of speed. And it's slowly slowing down. Which means, by that theory, certainly one acceptable interpretation is it had a beginning and it's going to have an end. Because, like a ball on a rubber string, bungee cord, the first string fast and it slows down, And then it gets to the end, it's going to come back. Because it's going away from gravity. Away from gravity. Of some mass that blew it out. Now, away from gravity is a distortion. It's going away from something. Because it's all moving away. And it's postulated as it cools a factor of speed, it will eventually cool until it'll hit the horizon where it can go no further, and then it'll start coming back. So the universe either ends with a big freeze or back to a big fry. Understand? Now, Einstein did not want this interpretation to take off. He hated the idea of a first cause, because to him, he confesses once, his God, Spinoza's God, his God was the whole thing. No outside force. Until this Big Bang Theory, and by the way, it had to do with a meeting at Mount Wilson Observatory up here. You can read about it in Stephen Hawking's Universe. This Catholic Lemaître priest, immediately when he understood this concept of the Big Bang, he grabbed on it and said, that was the starting point of the universe. He was a priest. Starting point of the universe, the moment of creation his church had been looking for. He thought he had found the perfect model, a universe which God had created as a primeval Adam, which continued to grow and expand like an oak tree from an acorn. Einstein argued with it, but when this Catholic priest found out Einstein was meeting with Hubble, who essentially proved and convinced Einstein of the beginning point, he came to meet with Einstein, and when he finished, Einstein said, it was the most beautiful and satisfying interpretation I've listened to, and went on to confess that creating the cosmological constant was the biggest blunder of his life. And he had come up with an idea of what is it that keeps all these galaxies that are going in every direction, away from us, and at set rates of speed, but they have a lot of space within their galaxies. What keeps them from falling in on themselves? What keeps them from crashing and coming together, leading to experiments in dark matter? And his original idea that there was a cosmological constant that caused these things to stay, because if what is being thought, the galaxies are going away eventually, not only will they run out of steam and freeze or come back and fry, there won't be anything left. I mean, we're in a galaxy that's going too. We just saw how fast we were going. Eventually, there's something back here that's the last one out of the pen. And as they go into whatever, there's nothing left. I can't even leave a memorial, because it's on something that's gone. And they postulated some kind of constant goings-on within this Big Bang that sent it all out there. Little bangs are creating the gaps to keep it going. And then he says it's wrong. Others have some kind of ingredient holding it together. I mean, in all their so-called, we only deal with the facts, man. They have to postulate these articles of faith to make their theories work. Now Stephen Hawking, who has a sense of humor and uses God often in his speeches, he comes up with a theory dealing with what they call quantum gravitation, trying to mix gravity in, and the random effect, the so-called uncertainty principle, was introduced as a background to the work of Hawking and others. Because, and this is going to be hard to do in the few minutes I got, but listen. The smallest particles, imagine whatever they are without the fancy names, it was ultimately discovered, as science says, Carl Sagan, this cosmos is all there is and all there ever was. And as C.S. Lewis argues so eloquently in his book, Miracles, then everything has to be connected, and there can be nothing random in this vast cosmological machine. If there's something random outside the system, incapable of being explained by the system, then, and he calls that subnatural, if there's a back door where something can get into this perfect system that is not predicated on the system itself, then why can't there be a front door where supernatural can get in? If science finally comes to the subnatural, naturalism and determinism that argued the first years of the scientific age is out the window. If they can sneak in like a rat at the bottom, they ought to be able to come in as a king through the front door. That's Lewis's argument. Well, these subparticles, it was discovered, you cannot measure position and velocity or speed at the same time. Because it takes light and the so-called waves, even though it's clusters, a quantum, to measure speed and to measure position, you use these, you shine light on the particles. Now, you measure position by narrowing the light waves so you can pinpoint where this sub-visible element is. You understand that? You have to isolate its position by getting short waves so that you've got it. It's microscopic. You've got its position. But the way you shorten the waves increases the temperature. You shorten the waves, it speeds it up. You increase the temperature. And thus, what you have to do to locate it increases the temperature so much that when it hits the particle, it changes it. So you can't measure position without changing the nature and thus knocking it off track. That's what I mean by changing the nature. The increased heat of the narrow band necessary to isolate position knocks it off until you can't measure its speed at the same time. Because speed must be measured with a lower heat intensity, wider waves, so you can measure how long it takes to go between points. But you can't measure position and speed same time. Therefore, by the time you measure speed and try to measure where it is, you change where it is. Now, that's about as hard as trying to look at time through a parade. But let me just simply say it. You can't do both. And since you can't do both, you've got a random element out here. Because the very act of changing its, of measuring its position affects its velocity, temperature, speed, direction, logical possibilities, and it's from this sub-element that the basic ingredients, up to molecules and on up to the rest of reality, is formed. So what C.S. Lewis postulated as the blow that would destroy naturalism arrived in quantum mechanics. There is a back door. There are elements that science cannot predict, cannot measure, cannot handle, that introduces a random effect into this purely mechanized, capable of being analyzed. And for a time, Stephen Hawking accepted the Big Bang. But then he's come up with a theory on quantum gravitational effects in which, to explain reality, he creates a fourth dimensional, what he calls imaginary time, in which the space is in a circle like the Earth, and the equator and all the latitudinal lines up to the North Pole, the South Pole. And when you stand here, the same rules apply, and you stand here, the same rules apply, and there is no beginning and end. It is perpetual. And therefore, Carl Sagan can embrace his latest book by saying, in his Brief History of Time, the same man who said, the cosmos is all there ever was, is, and ever will be. He writes the introduction to Hawking, because he can embrace what he says. And in his introduction, he says, we go about our daily lives understanding almost nothing of the world. In our society, it's still customary for parents and teachers to answer questions like the children ask, who want to know what a black hole looks like, what's the smallest piece of matter, why you remember the past and not the future, and how it is, and if there was chaos earlier, and why there is a universe. And it's still customary for parents and teachers to answer most of these questions with a shrug or with an appeal to vaguely recall religious precepts. Some are uncomfortable with issues like this because they so vividly expose the limitations of human understanding. He then praises Hawking and what he does in this book. And here is Sagan saying, this is also a book about God. God must think this is really nice. This little wave of the hand. This is also a book about... The guy who said on his TV series, there's cosmos is all there is, all there ever was, and all there ever will be. This is also a book about God. Or perhaps the absence of God. The word God fills these pages. Hawking embarks on a quest to answer Einstein's famous question about whether God had any choice in creating the universe. Hawking is attempting, as he explicitly states, to understand the mind of God. And this makes all the more unexpected the conclusion of the effort, at least so far. A universe with no edge, no beginning, no end. A universe with no edge in space, no beginning or end in time, and nothing for a creator to do. These are the heroes to be admired, as I learned to admire my professors who stole my faith from me by a subtle belittling of that faith, the basis of which they were totally ignorant about. Indeed, they had the attitude, if not worth even discussing. It's beneath our genius. I'll find the right one here in a minute. Beneath our genius, I must read this quote, and I'm done. Beneath our genius to even recognize it by talking about it. Here's Smith's comment. A chance conversation while I was teaching at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, lunching at its faculty club. I found myself seated next to a scientist. And as so often happened in such circumstances, the conversation turned to the difference between science and the humanities. We were getting nowhere when suddenly he broke in on something I was saying with the authority of a man who had discovered truth. "I have it," he exclaimed. "The difference between us is that I count and you don't." Now, get the double entendre. The key difference between the primordial and contemporary perspective in double entendre. I deal in numbers. You deal in words. I count. You talk. I have a language of precision. You have the language of poetry and ambiguity and multiplicity of meanings. There's the difference, folks. In the beginning was the word. Philosophers and religionists deal in words. God deals in words. The numbers he hurled out and made them perfect as the domain on which we would stand to marvel at such a creation and handiwork, and seek to hear the hearing of faith from the Creator. And in the beginning was not the numbers, in the beginning was the Word, before the numbers became. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. That gospel that brings that word of value and purpose and meaning and quality of life eternal is what breaks you out of the tunnel cemented on the foundation of scientism. And that's my message today. Oftentimes, a song that almost became a theme song for many years. And I think it fits right now as we take up the offering and close the service. In this tunnel world, unwilling to accept the fact that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And I could add the opening of the Ephesians letter that God, eulogia, an intrinsic part of His nature, translated blessed God, He blesses us by His Word. You look for the one behind this marvelous creation that we stand precariously on the cusp in between the macro and the micro. And instead of being like this compelling urge that goes clear back to Adam and Eve, pushed by the prince of this world to rule God out, to push Him out of the garden, to take control, we need to understand God's fed up. Not only did He leave His footprints, He sent His Son. That's the gospel story that we carry to the world. And the theme song we've used is "There's a Stranger in Town." Truly, in this tunnel vision society, He is a stranger. But thanks be to God, not a stranger to us. And His name is called Jesus. As we close the service, sing it, please.